You'd think that a book about butter would be filled with recipes, but that is exactly what Elaine Kosrova's book, Butter, A Rich History, is not filled with. Instead, it's brimming with ritual, history, politics, and science, and okay, truthfully, a couple of recipes. Elaine is the former editor of Culture, a magazine all about cheese. She's traveled the world researching this butter book, and our contributor, Melissa Clark, gets the report.
Elaine, hello. I'm so glad to be talking to you today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So one of the surprises for me in reading your book was to learn all about the connection between butter and religion. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that subject was really interesting for me, too, and surprising. I wasn't expecting to find that ancient cultures around the world used butter as a sacred tool for their spiritual practices. This is going back to the Sumerians, 2500 BC, and the Vedic Aryans, the Druids, the Hindus, the Buddhists. All of these cultures use butter in their worship practices. Most of these rituals are gone, but the Tibetan Buddhists still do these elaborate butter carvings called tormas that are central to their spiritual practice.
What do you think gives butter that kind of aura that makes it seem religious or spiritual in a way?
Well, for most of butter's history, in fact, the process of making butter was mysterious. It was an enigma. You know, how is it that you can take milk and through a process of simply rocking or beating it, you know, this invisible fat that's in the milk suddenly blooms into beautiful pieces of butter? So, you know, until the late 1800s, butter was little understood but highly valued. And so it was deemed, much like pearls and oysters or rainbows, you know, some of these wonderful mysteries in the world. So that was really, I think, at the root of why butter became so useful in a sacred way, for what it symbolized, essentially.
Which was magic.
Magic, exactly.
So historically, women have always played a very big role in butter making. Would you talk a little bit about women's roles in butter making?
Well, first of all, you know, it's not overstating it to say that women really founded the butter industry, because it was taboo for men to have anything to do with the dairy arts for most of the history of humankind and, you know, since we've been milking animals. I found this across the world, this taboo against men milking, making butter, doing cheese making, and that survived up until the 1800s. You know, milk is about birth and lactation and fertility. You know, it's very much a sort of feminine domain. And because they had a monopoly on butter making, you know, they gained a certain status from it because butter, of course, was valuable.
And you got to see some of this firsthand. I know you traveled to India and you got to see some traditional butter making.
I did. I went specifically to see the butter that's made from water buffalo milk. That would be the traditional milk in India, and that was for centuries. That was the animal that was most suited to the climate in India. And so water buffalo butter is their traditional butter. It's now disappearing. Cow butter has become much more prevalent. But the water buffalo butter is a cultured product that I was particularly interested in seeing how they make it. And so I was able to go to this small village in the north of India in Punjab and meet with these two elderly women. And they showed me how they take the water buffalo milk and they culture it overnight and they make this super delicious, rich yogurt called dahi. And that dahi is then put into a churn. You know, a generation ago, it would have been a beautiful metal churn. This particular day that I was visiting, they just put it into a plastic bucket. But they still use their unique system of churning, which involves a pole, a center pole, that has a cross piece on the bottom that goes into the milk, and then they alternately pull on the ends of a rope. So imagine this center pole is being spun around by the women pulling on the ropes either side, you know, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that system of churning doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So I really wanted to document that because, in fact, it is disappearing. Even in this particular remote village, the women told me that they use a blender now to make their butter. So I was glad I was able to document it and see it. I think in a generation, it probably won't exist anymore.
Now, you mentioned that it was cultured butter, and I know that I can buy cultured butter in the supermarket. I can also buy, I can buy a lot of different butters. I can buy high-fat European butter. I can buy sheep butter and goat butter in the health food store. Can you just walk us through the differences?
We'll start with the simplest first. That would be sweet cream butter. That is butter that's simply cream put into a churn until butter happens. And if it's an industrial churn, it happens in 3 seconds. But it's essentially just cream made into butter. If you have cultured butter, that means that the cream has been mixed with a lactic bacteria, sort of a cocktail of lactic bacteria, and allowed to ferment at least 12 hours, usually longer. And the point of that is to develop complexity of flavor in the cream. You know, butter has 120 different flavor compounds, and by culturing it, you can intensify some of the really good ones like diacetyl. That's the compound that gives us that quintessential butter flavor. And culturing also is synonymous with a little bit of acidity. So if you can balance like the sweet and the acid and the butteriness, that's a world-class butter. And then the European style, that's, you know, in quotes, that's what the many labels say, that essentially means a high-fat butter, a higher fat, because the standard in the States is for 80% fat in a stick of butter. The European style, higher fat butters can have 82, 84, 86% fat, which may not sound like a lot of difference, but when you're a baker, it makes a whole lot of difference.
So you would say bake with the European butter, and then if you were going to just spread some butter on bread and eat it, you would use the cultured butter for the extra flavor.
That's what I prefer. As far as baking, the higher fat butter is particularly good for pastry. If I'm making a cake, I don't actually feel like the extra butter fat makes much of a difference. The only exception would be a pound cake where I want that super rich density.
That makes sense. Now, talk to us about how butter gains its different flavors. You had written in the book that the flavor of butter comes from three different things, from the animal's diet, from the type and species of animal, and also from human artistry.
Yes, the variables that define the character of a butter. And they're essentially three very dynamic things, being the person, the plant, and the animal. The plant aspect in particular, it has a huge effect on the butter. You know, today animals can be fed grain or grass, and there's quite a variation in the butters that you get from that, not only the flavor, but nutritionally as well. A grass-fed butter definitely has more micronutrients in it than a butter that's from cows that are fed grain.
And that changes seasonally.
Yeah, and certainly in places where there's winter.
Right.
But even then, they're having a lot of silage and haylage. They're having fermented grass in addition to a little bit of grain. So we do have a really good system in place for keeping cows on grass year-round. So, I tell people, butter is such a staple, and you know, if you're going to have a little bit every day on your toast or your potato, whatever, I think it's really worth seeking out a good grass-fed butter.
Well, Elaine, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Elaine Kosrova's book is Butter, A Rich History. Melissa Clark's latest is Dinner in an Instant. Head to splendidtable.org for Elaine's butter-laced German pancake. That sounds great.